We begin this week in Western Myanmar, where disturbing reports have been emerging of the brutal crackdown underway on the region's Muslim Rohingyas. There are claims of widespread violence and arson across Rakhine State, and security forces there admit dozens of killings have been carried out in response to an earlier insurgent attack on police posts that left 12 officers dead. For 9 months, that part of Western Myanmar had been off limits to foreign media. When the ABC's Southeast Asia correspondent Liam Cochrane finally got his chance to visit the region, it was part of a media trip arranged by the Myanmar government. And as he discovered, that raised some really difficult ethical questions for him over what essentially could be a matter of life and death for those he encountered along the way.
We very nearly walked past her, the woman in black. She was standing near a bamboo bridge in a pretty but dirt-poor village in northern Rakhine State. That's the part of Myanmar that borders Bangladesh, and it's home to 1.1 million Rohingyas, stateless Muslims, considered one of the most persecuted people on earth. The woman in black held a black umbrella against the sun and had a striking face, young, beautiful, and utterly terrified. It was disarming. I stopped to take some photos of her. There was something about her manner. She half raised her hand like she wanted to tell us something, us journalists who'd been brought there by the government. Our minders were hurrying us along, flanked always by paramilitary police carrying assault rifles. I paused and asked a Myanmar journalist to observe the woman in black. She looks traumatised, the reporter said. And she did. I hadn't been able to put my finger on it, and I have no psychological training, but that's exactly how she seemed. Our minders hurried us along. We reluctantly started walking. But then I turned to the Myanmar reporter and said, "We have to talk to her. We have to go back." And so we did. We went back, found her, and she immediately started speaking. I stopped her so I could get my camera rolling. She spoke for less than 30 seconds in Rohingya language. We had no idea what she said, just that she was 18 years old. By this time, our minders were getting agitated. We thanked her in Burmese and kept walking. It's not easy to get to these villages in northern Rakhine State. It's a flight to Sitwe, a half-day boat ride north, speedboats from there, wooden longtails after that when the river gets too shallow, and then plenty of walking. This was the first time foreign reporters had been allowed into the area, with the important exception of Carlos Sardinha Galashi, who wrote a fantastic story for Time magazine in April. The rest of us tried to report on the violence in Rakhine State from afar. Here's the short version. In October, a newly formed militant group attacks police posts, killing 9 officers and stealing dozens of weapons. The police and army seal off the area, and they launch what they call a clearance operation. More than 70,000 Rohingyas flee to Bangladesh. There, they tell stories of murder, rape, and arson. Really horrific stuff. A woman being raped by soldiers. Her child cries out. They slit its throat. Malaysia calls it genocide. The United Nations says possible crimes against humanity. The security forces and the Myanmar government deny allegations of atrocities. Around the time of our trip, 9 months after that first attack, there's another killing spree going on. This time, men are being secretly killed in remote villages. Often they have some link to the police or the army as translators or informants. It's thought the killers are part of the new militant group, but nobody can say for sure. Two of those killed were people who spoke with local journalists during 2 previous government-arranged trips. One of them was murdered on a picturesque creek bank just a few hundred metres from where the woman in black stood. The risk of her talking to us was high. All day I wondered, what did she say? There was a lot of that on the trip. The government hadn't brought any Rohingya speakers, and their Burmese speakers couldn't really speak English, so translation was pretty difficult. Hard to know whether that was a deliberate effort to keep us in the dark or just a glaring oversight. Obviously, they wanted to say to the world, look, we let the foreign media in. They probably also hoped we found nothing so they could continue claiming the Rohingya allegations were exaggerated or just made up. On day one, several of us from the English language media insisted that our photos not be used for propaganda. We were on the front page of the government-run national newspaper. But we did find serious allegations. In fact, every time we insisted our minders and guards stay behind, locals, mostly women, told us about murders, arbitrary arrests, fear. One woman said her father was tied up and burned alive in a house. The travel was exhausting, the ethical dilemmas tough. Were we endangering everyone we spoke to? Should we have agreed to come on this trip at all? The whole five-day trip really boiled down to a couple of occasions where we engineered some freedom to report without our minders. Just a few hours, really. But even that was enough to find anecdotal evidence of some very serious crimes. I think the Myanmar government deserves some credit for arranging the trip, albeit late and carefully managed. Local media is often very compliant. We were not. We changed the itinerary to go to the villages with the worst allegations of violence. We stopped at places not on the schedule, and we insisted on private interviews. We asked repeatedly for an assurance that our sources be protected. Our minders said they couldn't guarantee people's safety in these areas. We were mostly polite, but when necessary, voiced our demands firmly. They accommodated most of our requests and were no doubt pretty happy when it was all over. Back in Bangkok, I started preparing stories for TV, radio, and online. After about 15 hours, I was mostly done, and then I realised something. I hadn't got the woman in black's statement translated. A friend of a friend did it quickly, emailing me back those few lines.
The Rakhinese entered and aimed the gun at my forehead. They held my hand strongly and did what they wanted to me. Then I was told to go back, but I didn't. I was sitting there. Then they started beating me and they took off my clothes. They beat me too much and did what they wanted. The military did this.
I felt sick. Tears welled up. It's one thing to report on this stuff, hundreds dead, thousands raped, whole villages burned down, but when it's a person you've met and connected with, however briefly, the outrage feels very personal. I changed my story, of course, to include her allegations. I didn't use her name or village, and we blurred her face in the photo. But of course, it's very easy for the security forces to find out who talked. And they did. Several weeks after our trip, a committee of government officials travelled all the way to that remote village and interviewed some Rohingya women, including the woman in black. As far as I've heard, there's been no retribution against the people we spoke to, nor has there been any investigation. Given the government's track record, it would be highly unlikely to see any charges against soldiers for the rape of a stateless woman. But for a moment, she was heard. At great personal risk, she told her story, which she wanted to do. It's something, but it's not enough. This is Liam Cochrane for Correspondence Report.